Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the Employers Insurance of Wausau versus Titan International. Mr. Gorman.
May it please the court. My name is Brett Gorman. I represent the appellants Dynair Corporation and Titan International, Inc. We're here today on an appeal from a summary judgment ruling by Judge Scott in the Central District on cross motions for summary judgment that were presented by the parties following the close of discovery. We're seeking a reversal of that ruling and the entry of summary judgment in favor of the appellants. This is a fairly simple case that involves the a dispute between the parties regarding retrospective premiums charged under a workers' compensation policy. And specifically, the insurance company wrote policies back in the period of 1999 all the way up through 1985. And the way the policies work is there's a basic premium that is established, and then based upon the loss history, there are subsequent calculations made called retros. And the dispute arises out of a retrospective premium adjustment that was made in June of 2000 that actually led to the payment of a check in the amount of $240,000 to Wausau.
Counsel, before you get too far into the merits, would you address the threshold issue of the timeliness of the appeal?
Yes, I will. Thank you. I thought this issue would have been resolved after the initial brief that we filed and the court's question that was issued back in May, and specifically whether the amended judgment that was entered by Judge Scott in February required a separate document. And I admittedly, I think we hacked around a little bit under the new rule trying to fix the reason why the appeal was timely as to all issues. But the fact of the matter is the committee advisory comments to the new Rule 58 or the amendments specifically provide that a separate document is required in a case where there is an amended judgment that is entered on a Rule 59 motion. And what happened was the insurance company filed a post-judgment motion to amend the judgment seeking an award of pre-judgment interest. If that had been denied, I don't think there would have been a separate document required under the new rule.
Why does the rule say dispose of rather than deny? Because isn't it your position that only if the motion is denied is the separate document dispensed with? If it's granted and the motion is amended and the judgment is amended, then on your view, a separate document is required.
That's right.
Why did they use the word dispose instead of deny?
Well, the language of the committee comments says, and if the disposition of the motion...
The rule. Why does the rule say dispose instead of deny? Because if it's granting is a mode of disposition, but on your view, it's a mode that requires the entry of a separate document.
Either way, if it's disposed
not
of...
Not either way. If it's a grant, you say there has to be a separate document. Because if there's a grant, there's amended judgment.
Right.
So why doesn't the rule say deny, since that's the only mode of disposition that doesn't require a separate document?
And that, I think, is the reason for the confusion. But clearly, there was an amended judgment issued that required a separate document. Once the amended judgment was issued, all bets were off on the prior judgment. We could have filed, I think this is the way to look at it, we could have filed another post-judgment motion, not trying to revive our prior attacks on the prior judgment, but attacking the award of pre-judgment interest. And that would, if we would have filed that within 10 days of the amended judgment, that would have been timely, and it would have continued on from there. Clearly, I think under the advisory comments, there was a separate document required. And admittedly, we hacked around early on trying to explain the basic, I think we presented two alternate theories for why all of the appeal would be timely, and I think we're timely under all of those theories, but more specifically, the court's question clarified that issue just by directing us to the amended judgment and whether that requires a separate document. Clearly it did. On the, if I can go back to the merits of the appeal, the issue here is Judge Scott's ruling is incorrect for the reason that she entered judgment on count one, breach of contract. Titan and Dynier did nothing to breach this contract. There is no provision in the contract that governs this situation where there was an error in the database that led to an incorrect issuance of a check.
Well, and that's it doesn't matter what's called breach of contract or restitution or unjust enrichment. I mean, they paid you under a mistake, and they corrected the mistake, so they're entitled to their money back.
I think the reason it's important for why this is not a breach of contract claim, if the court is going to affirm what the district court did, I think it has to do it on one of the equitable theories, because there's no provision that we can point to. Titan and Dynier didn't breach this contract.
All right, so we call it restitution or unjust enrichment.
But once we get into those equitable theories, there are there is at least a question of fact.
What is the question of fact?
There are two. One is the calculations, whether they owed the money, and if so, how much. And that issue was put in. There's a factual issue between what the insurance company's experts say and what Titan and Dynier's experts say.
Are you talking about the arithmetical calculation or what? What do you mean by calculation?
I'm talking about the fact that we hired an expert who looked at this. The insurance company's experts looked at it, and they said, and I think they criticized our affidavit for reaching some ultimate conclusion. That's what they did. They said, you're owed the money. Our expert looked at this and tried to calculate what the right retrospective premium was, and when she came back, she said, I can't tell based upon the information that I have, because there is no way, based upon what Wausau has provided, for us to go back in the early 1980s, 1979 and 1985 policy periods, and determine whether the factors that were used.
Well, I don't understand that. Those state factors, they're public.
We were only able to obtain, I think, one factor.
From whom did you try to
obtain? I think it was Texas, because that's what our expert. That's where she
was. Well, did you try to, where did you go to obtain them?
She obtained those for us.
Where did she go to obtain them?
I believe she obtained them through the Department of Insurance.
Well, why couldn't, I say these are public documents. Why couldn't you obtain them?
Because, and I'm not sure that we couldn't have obtained them.
Well, that's critical.
I don't think so.
They're public documents. They're public documents.
It's not our burden.
It's
the burden. It's the burden of the insurance company forward and
they
show.
When they gave you that huge refund check, you didn't say, "Oh, we're owed. Prove to us that we're not owed more. Show us what those state factor." You didn't do that. You were happy to cash the check. What reason is there for us to think that the state factors changed between when you got the check and when they asked for the refund?
Because I believe they have to be filed by the carrier in each state for each policy period, showing what factors are going to
be
charged.
Well, if they've changed, look, as I say, you accepted the huge refund. You didn't think it was necessary to make them prove what their state factors were. So it seems to me the only leg you have to stand on is that sometime between the calculation of that sending that check, something happened to those state factors so that they're not entitled to the full refund. Well, why don't you go and look and see if any of those state laws or regulations have changed?
That's why we hired the expert.
But she didn't do it, apparently.
She was unable to obtain
that. I don't understand
that.
We're not talking about state factors back in 85. We're talking about, has there been any change since that refund? If she can't figure, why can't she?
And I understand
this is public.
That.
These are regulations and statutes.
And this just goes to show, I mean, if it's their burden to show what they're entitled to.
Forget burden. Why can't you find these regulations and statutes?
I don't think they're in statutes.
Well, where are they?
I think they're filed. They're documents that are filed
are
in all of the
state
various
states. Aren't they?
Right.
These are official state documents.
That's right.
So why can't you find them?
It should not be. How easy would it have been for Wausau to come forward based upon our affidavit that says we can't tell, based upon what has been presented, whether or not you're owed the money, and if so, how much? How easy would it have been for them to come forward and say, we will resolve your problem?
Here's what I think is really fundamentally frivolous about your position. When someone receives a bill, you don't write a letter to the seller, whoever is billing you, and say, prove that this is the correct bill. You have to have some reason to think it's the incorrect bill. And then it's your burden to come forward with some evidence that you're being billed improperly.
And that's what we were never able to do.
That's not true. That is true.
We were not able to do that.
Of course you're, because your only defense against this bill is based on public documents, these state insurance regulations.
But that's not true that that's
suppose our only... Suppose you received a bill from your bank and you said to them, how do I know your interest charge doesn't violate state usury laws? Prove to me that it doesn't violate state usury laws. It's your burden to prove it doesn't violate state usury laws. That would be thrown out in 5 minutes. You have no basis for that.
I see that I'm eating into my rebuttal time, but there is one alternative basis other than the calculation that also is grounds for us to have this case reversed at the summary judgment stage, and that is the fact that once we're into this equitable position that the Wausau has to be in order to recover because there's no provision in the contract, there is a case that we cited, the John Spry Lumber case, that basically says that an equity will not reward a party who has got itself in a problem based upon its own negligence. And what the facts show in the case and what the evidence was that was developed, and they even admitted it, they were the ones who basically entered the wrong data into the database.
Look, you're not arguing, are you, that if you receive, suppose someone owes you $10 and he sends you a check for $1 million. You're saying you can keep the $1 million if you show that it was a negligent mistake on the part of the payor? That's ridiculous.
What the case says and what our position would be.
What's your answer to my question?
If it was their negligence and they had knowingly basically botched the deal, then I think under these cases...
Come on. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. So you can keep $1 million when you're owed $10 because some clerk in the bank made a negligent error?
The issue would be on summary judgment, looking at all the facts.
Get it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Barnes?
May it please the Court, James Barnes on behalf of the plaintiff appellee. I'd like to very briefly address certain new contentions raised for the first time in the defendant's briefs, then at length what I believe is the threshold question of jurisdiction, and time permitting the well-articulated, well-laid-out reasoning with respect to the trial court's disposition of this case. Defendant's brief claims, in order to find a logical path, hopefully for the court to reverse, that the issue of legality came from nowhere, that the trial court kind of inserted it to get the result. But in fact, the illegality of the contracts was repeatedly explicitly and implicitly at issue. And I quote from only one document. Defendants state in the response brief, the defendants did not raise illegality as an affirmative defense and never took the position that the insurance contracts were illegal. And that may be found at page 15 of their brief. However, in responding to plaintiff's interrogatory number 10, which was directed directly at defendant's affirmative defense, the defendants state, in part, and I quote, based upon an investigation by Titan and Denier, members of the Wausau Group overcharged for workers' compensation coverage by illegally inflating a state-regulated premium factor. And that may be found at docket entry number 47. They did allege illegality of the contracts. The court's analysis with respect to the burden flowing from that was absolutely correct.
It's not an illegality. It's not a defense of illegality. Defense of illegality is a situation where a party enters the contract and is perfectly content with a contract, and but then tries to get out of it by arguing it's an illegal contract. Here, their argument is that you made a billing mistake. The contract required that you comply with these state factors, and you didn't. And just a mistake in how you executed the contract. Nothing illegal about the contract.
I certainly agree, Your Honor, and I point out the illegality issue as they have raised it. I don't think one needs it, because I think the burden of proof or lack of same speaks for itself in terms of the disposition on the summary judgment motions. As to the threshold question, in November of last year, the district court issued a final judgment. Shortly thereafter, the parties filed various motions. Two of those motions were Rule 59 motions. Under Rule 4A, the filing of the Rule 59 motions disposed of, or pardon me, told the time for appeal until 30 days after their disposition. Both Rule 59 motions, plaintiff's motion for statutory interest, defendant's motion for reconsideration, were disposed of at the same time in February. 30 days from that date, either party must have filed their appeal.
No judgment.
That is correct. No judgment was required.
Well, it's very odd. Well, it's very odd, though. I mean, she granted the motion. I mean, the judge granted the motion, but didn't get around to, Judge Scott granted the motion, but didn't get around to actually issuing the amended judgment until, what, March 11th or something?
Correct.
So can't you always wait till the Rule 58 judgment is entered?
Not in a Rule 59 motion. I think to reach that result, you have to ignore Rule 58 states.
In the ordinary Rule 59 case, a judgment is entered, Rule 59 motion is filed, it's denied, and then your 30 days starts to run. But this case is unusual. It's granted, but instead of the grant being accompanied by the issuance of a new judgment, the issuance of a new judgment was delayed.
Yes, Judge, but I believe there was no requirement for an amended judgment, a separate document under Rule 58A1D. A separate document is not required for an order disposing of a motion
but
to alter
amend. But it is for an amended judgment, and if the motion is granted, I mean, really, it's a badly worded rule, but if the motion is granted, it means the judgment is amended. You have an amended judgment.
Yes, I mean, in that the judgment has literally changed from it was. But Rule 58 says, on a Rule 59 motion, you do not need to file a separate document. So the court didn't. The later motion for statutory costs is a Rule 54 motion. You do have to file a separate document. And that's what the court did. I think what the court did under the rules is exactly correct. It issued a separate document when the rule said it needed to. It did not when the rule said it did not have to.
Well, but doesn't the... Well, that's a good argument. But didn't the separate that later entered March 11th judgment, didn't that also include not only the cost but also the prejudgment interest, which she wasn't that what she granted your motion for prejudgment? Wasn't that the Rule 59 motion?
Yes, that was our rule. Yes.
Okay. So, but doesn't that Rule 5th, that second judgment, the March 11th judgment, doesn't that include the prejudgment interest?
Yes, Judge. As it also includes the original judgment
right.
in November.
Right.
I don't think that that's relevant to the question of the timing of the appeal.
Right.
Under the rule, and I think the court properly noted, and Mr. Gorman spoke at length about the advisory committee notes. The extraction from the advisory committee notes, to follow those requires you to negate the clear, plain, unequivocal language of Rule 58. Is not required. You won't be asked to modify it, to explain it, to supplement it. You'll be asked to change is not sometimes or may be or may not be. Rule 58 is absolutely clear. A separate document was not required to be filed on the Rule 59 motions. Consequently, it wasn't filed by the court. The court filed an amended judgment later.
Okay, well, so does your argument come down to saying that the March 11th judgment, although it purports to be, you know, comprehensive and so on, is actually just the grant of costs? And so it's really a Rule 54 order, which
yes.
doesn't have any significance for the
under the rules, I presume a trial court acting under the rules. Under the rules, it needed to issue a separate document after the grant of the motion for costs. I don't see that. I think the issue of when the clock began to run for appeal was determined upon the denial of the Rule 59 motion. And my read on the advisory notes, it seems to me with the change to Rule 58, there's been a vagrancy of different opinions or phraseology by district courts that have led to a lot of confusion. I think Rule 58 is putting the burden on appellants who are most aware of the particulars of their case and what post-judgment motion practice is going on to act under those motions to be determining for themselves when they need to appeal. So you don't have appeals that are premature, that never in fact started to toll. I think the underlying rationale is a sound one, and I think to maintain Rule 58, as the clear language provides, requires this court to find that the appeal was late and thus jurisdiction does not lie with this honorable court.
If Mr. Barnes, if the
yes.
district court had denied your pretrial interest motion when you wanted to appeal that, when would the time start to run on that?
Precisely as it did in the circumstances here, we contend.
February 4th.
Yes, February 4th. Both the our Rule 59 motion for statutory interest and defendant's motion for reconsideration, also Rule 59, were both disposed of on February 4th. Yes, Judge. As to the underlying disposition by the trial court, and I believe this court has already referenced in a query, I believe there are solid grounds not only to affirm the court's disposition with respect to breach of contract, but clearly, equally so, to affirm on alternative grounds, count to restitution. Regarding breach of contract, the defendants, after the close of fact discovery, and still having failed to comply with plaintiff's discovery, there being three pending discovery motions reflected in the docket, rendered moot by the disposition of summary judgment, and I may add, since the inference seems to be out there that we're withholding documents, the record is absolutely bare of any motion at any time suggesting plaintiff was not in full and complete compliance with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Fact discovery is over. We haven't been able to get a discovery. They tried out the expert conclusion that certain premium factors contained in the insurance policies may, could, might be in violation of state law. From that, pure speculation, they now contend the trial court improperly shifted the burden of proof But they're incorrect. The trial court was absolutely correct in assigning the burden of proof and absolutely correct in noting that merely creating confusion, suggesting doubt, is not sufficient and certainly does not constitute evidentiary facts. Plaintiff met fully its prima facie case. Offer, acceptance, consideration, performance, breach, resulting damages. Plaintiff's statement of exhibits is voluminous. It's comprehensive. All of the policies, all three lines, all policy years, all of the retrospective premium adjustments, all of the backup to that, all of the loss ones, all of the invoices, the statement of account, the endorsement pages. Plaintiff's experts said they were correct. Plaintiff's expert false. Defendant's experts say the calculations were correct. Parties have a right to rely on contracts when they seek a breach for same, that they bring to bear everything, they make their prima facie case, all the documents. Defendants don't rebut, they just speculate, they conjure, they duck the central question. The trial court acted absolutely properly under the rules in assigning and finding for the plaintiff on its breach of contract count. Equally so, restitution count two, based on mistake of fact. The record is clear that this court could affirm based on that. It is a textbook example of a mistake of fact. But for an unknown systems database error, a credit would not have posted to the defendants, and then the plaintiff consequently would not have issued the check in error because the defendants weren't due any money. This is clearly a mistake of fact. The facts surrounding the matter are undisputed, and this matter, I would hope, would be affirmed on count one, but count two is equally viable and directly on point with the circumstances. Defendant's suggestion that, I'm not sure how to say it, if you made a mistake, you were negligent, and therefore you can't recover. It seems to me a mistake of fact, by definition, says you made a mistake. I mean, you were, in some respects, negligent. You made an honest error. And you have to act appropriately, and we certainly did, in correcting it and providing everything they needed. And the long and short is they wouldn't give us the money back. Lastly, with respect to statutory interest, I believe defendants contending that because they had a good faith defense, statutory interest should not lie. But the good faith defense goes to the legal merits of their position. They're required to pay premiums when due and owing. They didn't do that. Moreover, their conduct here is clearly not in good faith. When one considers, before we had to file suit, we dealt with their risk manager, a person who specializes in insurance. We gave him everything he requested. The end result was, rather than have the matter resolved and avoid litigation, all the documents were turned over to legal counsel, to their corporate legal counsel in-house. She testified in her deposition she never looked at the documents. Now, her position doesn't have to be our position, but how can you be acting in good faith if you won't even look at the documents sent to you relevant to avoiding having to get into litigation? In short, or in summary, I do not believe jurisdiction lies. Assuming arguendo this court finds to the opposite, I believe the district court fully, fairly, and completely disposed of this matter properly on the breach of contract count, and were it necessary to look at, could equally be affirmed based on restitution based on mistake of fact. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Mr. Gorman.
Thank you. I would like to back up just briefly and continue to address the defense that I believe we have to the equitable theories on the basis of Wausau's negligence. And I think...
I didn't understand in the brief Wausau's jurisdictional argument very well. Now I understand it better. I think it's powerful, so I'd be interested in your comment. So what he's saying is that language of the rule refers to, you know, disposition of the Rule 59 e-motion. So on February 4th, motion was your motion was denied, their motion was granted. So that was that. And that the only thing that happened afterwards was the filing of the motion for costs. And although the March 11th judgment repeats the previous judgment, all it adds is an award of costs. And an order awarding costs doesn't toll the time for appealing. So is there some flaw in that? I was saying sounds good. It didn't sound good at first. Now it sounds good. Well, is there a flaw there?
The motion for costs was filed as part of the motion for prejudgment interest. There was one motion filed.
It may be one piece of paper, but they're analytically different. Prejudgment interest is you know, substantive, and costs are Rule 54D. So if the judge had on March 11th just issued an order awarding costs and had not repeated the previous judgment, you'd be out of luck, right?
If she had not issued an award of prejudgment interest that then required an amended judgment, that's what she did.
Why wouldn't the grant of the Rule 59 motion awarding prejudgment interest on February 4th, why couldn't that be the end? Why would there have to be a further judgment?
Because the cases that we cited, I think it's the Osternak case and McNabola, a motion for prejudgment interest opens up the prior judgment and requires an amended judgment. It goes to the merits of the district court's opinion and the actual ruling.
But once the motion is granted on February 4th, why doesn't that? Then you know that the motion has been amended. I mean, the judgment has been amended.
Because the new rule specifically says an amended judgment requires a separate document. And that's obviously what Judge Scott thought. She didn't issue her final, she says in her minute entry, Rule 58 judgment is entered in the March date. After everything was done and after she entered that separate document on her docket.
Okay,
I see that my time is up. We would just ask for the relief that we've requested. Thank you.
Could I just ask you one more question? You say you had trouble getting these state factor manuals or what have you. Couldn't you have asked for them in discovery?
I think we could have, but as this case progressed, I mean, what happened, as happens in a lot of cases, we didn't understand the retrospective premium adjustments. We put it in the hands of an expert after all the discovery was done and said, can you please tell us what this means? And that's what she came back with. And she said, and she was the only one who did this, by the way. The insurance company's experts did not do it. They rendered an opinion on the ultimate issue. Yes, they owe the money. She said, hey, I have tried to take a look at this. I have tried to determine what the basis for the retrospective premiums are under the policies, and I can't do it. And that was her response. And that's what we submitted, and we believe and we continue to believe it is their burden.
Hired at the end of discovery?
She was hired at the end as everything was dwindling down, and the expert disclosure date was, I think, after the close of fact discovery.
So this issue of the retrospective interpretation wasn't an apparent issue at the outset?
Well, certainly it was, but we didn't understand it, and that's the whole point. And this gets back to dumping 4,000 pages of documents on us and saying, here, you figure it out. Our response was, we don't understand.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Farman. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.